Blog Talk Radio.
Texas on Tuesday, March 26, day number 85 of 2013, and it's going to be a very interesting show tonight. We're going to be chatting with Brian Lloyd French, who is a Canadian friend, who's also the author of the book Mojito, which is a wonderful novel about Cuba. And by the way, we have a link to the novel and show information. We definitely recommend that you check it out. But we're going to be talking about Brian's novel. We're also going to be talking about Cuba. We've been doing some shows about Cuba lately, last night about Yaoni Sanchez, and tonight more in general about Cuba as well as the novel. And we want to get a perspective that we don't usually get, and that is the perspective of someone who has actually been to Cuba and has been visiting and talking to the Cuban people. So that's a perspective that we're going to get tonight from Brian. So it's going to be a very good program tonight with Brian. Now, just a quick update on our book, Cubanos in Wisconsin. We now have it in Kindle and print, and it's available, of course, on the website, Cubanos in Wisconsin. And my son redid the website. He did a great job. The website, it's the same website, I mean the same link, URL or whatever they call it. But he redid it, and he moved some things around, and the thing looks great, actually. He looked for some interviews, put some interviews on there, and it looks absolutely great. So you ought to check it out, because it looks absolutely great. CubanosInWisconsin.com. And by the way, I had the opportunity to speak to the Rotarians today. I had a great time here in Plano, Texas, with the Rotary Club. We're going to take a break, and we'll be back with Brian right after this. This is Silvio Canto in Dallas, and just a quick historical note, as long as we're talking to an author tonight, this is a very important day in the history of American books. In 1920, F. Scott Fitzgerald published his first novel. It was called A Side of Paradise. Now, I'm not familiar with that novel, but of course I think everybody is familiar with The Great Gatsby, because we had to read that in school, one of the great American novels of the 20th century. So we congratulate F. Scott Fitzgerald. This was the day that he published his first book. And having just published my first book, I think I know how he feels. It is very exciting to publish your first book. Let's say hello to Brian. How are you, Brian?
I'm doing great, Silvio. Thanks so much.
How is everything up in Toronto?
Spring is here. It may be snowing over much of North America, but we have spring.
Absolutely. Well, I know we've had you on the show before, but it's been a while since we had you on. So why don't you give us a little bio?
Well, as far as my end, I've been a newspaper columnist, and I've always written, and mostly you can't make much of a living in writing, so I've been a business guy, and I've had a chance to travel all over the world, do interesting things, and I'm a little bit of a sportsman. I played basketball in university, so this is a big month for me. And I played baseball as a younger guy, and I still play slow pitch, and I play it badly, but I still try.
Slow pitch is softball, right? Is that what they call it up there? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, go ahead. Yeah, go ahead.
No, I was just saying, it is about as different as an elephant from a chicken. Slow pitch and baseball.
Yeah, slow pitch. If you've played fastball or hardball, that switch to slow pitch, that ball takes an eternity to get to you when you've been playing regular baseball. Well, we're actually going to do a quick baseball conversation here before we get to our topic tonight. But you being a baseball fan, I wanted to let you know that we're going to be doing a baseball show tomorrow night, and
sure.
we put together a show here with some friends in the Dallas area, and we're going to be making some predictions, and I just wanted to give you a little anticipated prediction that I am picking the Blue Jays to play a postseason game this year. In fact, One scenario that I have has the Blue Jays winning the American League East. My other scenario has the Blue Jays going in as one of the two wild cards and then playing one game or getting eliminated or whatever. But I think it's going to be a good year for the Blue Jays. I'm excited. I think you fans in Toronto are going to have a pretty good team.
Well, my highlight of the last 2 months is that they've been rescreening the 1992 and 93 World Series, Silvio, and we haven't won anything since. So with that level of frustration in mind, I'm not all that confident.
Interesting. Well, they had a very, very busy offseason, to say the least. I mean, they were one of the most aggressive teams in the offseason.
You know, one of the impressive things, though, if you look at the roster, Silvio, is how big the guys are. Like, they have a very large baseball team. I mean, you know, the one Cuban they have left, he's a six-footer, Arencibia. And they have all their guys are over 6 feet, all over 200 pounds. I mean, they're big guys.
Do they have any speed?
Well, yeah, lots of speed. I mean, Reyes, the shortstop.
Right, yeah.
You know, he's 6'1".
Right.
Right? And all their guys can run. Lori's very quick at third base. He's 6 foot 225. I mean, they're football players.
Right. But The one thing that I like about the Jays this year is that they've got a pretty good pitching staff. I think they're going to be. I know that you guys have not won something in a while, and we had that feeling down here in Texas too for a long time. We hadn't won anything. But I'm actually, as I say, I'm going to predict that. The Blue Jays are going to win the American League East, and simply because I think the Yankees are just old and, you know, too many disabilities. The Red Sox are really rebuilding. The Orioles, they got to do it again, which is always the question when you have a young team. And I think the Rays are probably going to be your toughest competition. It's either going to be the Rays or the Jays winning the American League East, and then the other one going in as a wild card. That's how I'm kind of predicting it.
All right, I think you're pretty close. We'll see what the Orioles do, if they can sustain it after last year. But, you know, I would put my money on the Jays, but I'll tell you why. It's because Dickey. You know, you got a guy throwing a floater up, right? And then you're going to have three guys throwing it at 98. So, you know, the guy that throws knuckleball tends to decimate the opponents for another game or two.
Right, that's true. You're right about that. Now, I don't know, and just one more thought about baseball. Has any knuckleball pitcher ever succeeded on a artificial turf? Because you guys, I think you're the only team in the American League with an artificial turf, maybe even in Major League Baseball. Do you know? Because do they put the ball on the ground a lot when you're a guy like Dickey? Does he give up a lot of ground balls?
Not really. No, you tend to miss them. So anything you hit in the ground is generally pretty soft with a handle.
No, okay.
And
right.
You pop a lot up and you miss a lot and foul a lot off. And don't forget, he throws it pretty quick. So he throws it in the 80s.
Oh, okay.
So you get a floater coming in at the 80s. So, I mean, and he throws a fastball. So, we'll see. There aren't that many knuckleballers around anyway. So it's hard to measure.
I know we had a very good one here in Texas, Charlie Huff, for a long time. Long time. But he was pitching here in a park, at least the old park, not the new one, but the old park was a little bit more pitching friendly. But anyway, I'm predicting the Blue Jays. So as we communicate during the baseball season, remember my prediction. I think the Blue Jays are going to be in the postseason this year, and I think you guys are going to have a lot of fun with your team. Well, let's get into our topic of Cuba. As I mentioned at the beginning, we've done some shows recently on Cuba. We had one last night on Yoani Sanchez that I thought was a pretty informative program. But let's begin with your book. I said at the beginning that it's a great book. I guess tell us as much as you can about the book without giving it away.
Well, it's the story of my travels through Cuba. And the people I've met and the things I've learned and places I've seen, and I wrote a spy story around it. I have a rapidly diminishing number of friends in Cuba because so many have left. So the people that are in my book about Cuba, and it takes place mostly in Havana, Pinar del Rio, and in the south near Guantanamo, And so I talk a lot about the place and the people, how they survive, how they get along, what it's like to live under the government they live under, how they survive, and a lot of that. But meanwhile, I write a spy story, and it involves a Canadian, he's actually a Canadian assassin of sorts, but he's kind of a funny guy. He's like me. He likes some sports and things like that, but every author writes about himself. So.
That's right.
So you know, like F. Scott Fitzgerald was a great Gatsby. You know. So it's a thriller, but it's also a travelogue. And it explains, Cuba is an isle of lies, and it explains how people survive by evading the situation. They survive in very difficult situations, very difficult positions.
Yeah, no, I think I love that, and I know you mentioned that the last time you had you on, that Cuba is in fact an island of lies, because that's how you live. You know, you have two faces, as many people have told me. You have the public face and, you know, your private face, and in the public face you're, you know, in favor of the revolution, but in private, of course, you don't like the revolution. That's what Cuba has become. But let me ask you a question. I may have asked you this the last time. What interested a Canadian like you in Cuba? What was it about Cuba that interested you as much as it has?
Well, I have a friend who's a filmmaker who wrote a novel, well, it's quite a while ago now, probably 20 years ago, 25 years ago. And it was a spy story about a Canadian guy who went down to Jamaica, and he got involved in all kinds of trouble down there. And he didn't have a copy. We happened to be going through an old used book sale one time, and there was a copy there. And we always collaborate on things. And I looked at it, I said, I'm going to write a sequel. So I started writing a sequel and started thinking about where should we put it and what's an interesting place that could follow up in Jamaica. And I thought, Cuba. What a great place. So I started traveling there just to get an understanding of the place. I think I went there first in, you know, 2000, and sort of haven't stopped going. So the problem was we ran into copyright issues. So I had to dump all the characters and dump all the references and everything and start from scratch again. But that's how I originally got interested. Then once I got down there and I started making friends and things and going to wild and crazy places. My website's got some amazing video on there. And I look back now and I think I can't believe that I was in that position.
And we have link to your website on the show information, yeah.
Yeah, in the videos I'm there with guys that are actually characters in the novel. And I can talk a little bit more about them because they've all left Cuba now. But it was a birthday party of a guy. And these guys, another guy, one of the guys who was there who is in the video, is in prison now for murder. I got hanging out with these guys, and they became my friends. And they live maybe outside the law. But, of course, the law in Cuba isn't exactly law as we know it.
Right, yeah. What if you were explaining Cuba, I loved your explanation, Island of Lies, but if you were explaining Cuba to somebody who doesn't know anything about Cuba, I had that experience today when I spoke at the Rotary Club about my book. You know, some people knew Cuba, a lot of other people didn't really know much about it. And how would you explain, I mean, if you were sitting next to somebody in an airplane and you started talking to him and he said, hey, tell me about Cuba. I don't know anything about it. What two or three things would you say about it?
I'd say it's the meanest police state in the Americas at the present time. I'd say the people have the least human rights of any place in the Americas at the given time. And nothing is as good or as bad as it appears.
That's excellent. Now, why is it that those three points that you just expressed, the human rights, you know, the police state, we don't seem to hear that from a lot of people who go to Cuba. You know, a lot of times people will go to Cuba and they'll come back saying wonderful things, and it surprises me, people like me, because I'm saying, wait a minute, what did you see in Cuba? So why do you have such a good view of Cuba, and so many other people just don't see what you saw?
I think most Americans that go there are guided. And very commonly they're guided by people who have a vested interest in them returning to America with a positive perspective. When my wife and I were down last month, we stayed in a fancy hotel because, frankly, my wife likes fancy hotels, and they have some in Havana now. And it was almost totally filled by Americans. Now, as an aside, most of them had either Obama hats or Obama sweatshirts or T-shirts. But, you know, they were having this experience in Cuba where they stay in a hotel that would be 4-star in Manhattan, really a beautiful hotel. They're guided carefully around to see the things that people want them to see, and they're told stories that people want them to hear. So it's really a big propaganda exercise. So, you know, my comment is that Cuba doesn't have a government; it has a propaganda agency.
Interesting.
And they do that very well.
Yeah. Yeah, and this is, you know, what I've often told people is that if you go to Cuba, you're going to be supervised. You're not going to have freedom. And they say, oh, come on, don't exaggerate. It really doesn't happen that way. But I'm glad to hear what you're saying, because you're confirming everything that I hear about Cuba. Now, one of the things that I wanted to ask you about is the political situation in Cuba now. And then I also want to ask you about some stories about prostitution that I've read lately, but the political situation is, of course, that Raul Castro will be retiring, I guess, in 2018, we hear, and that he's basically passing on, or he has selected his successor. How do you feel about that?
You know, he was going to retire in 2014, I think, a couple months ago, but 2018 gives him 10 years since he supposedly assumed power. And in the Congress in 2011, he said that nobody would serve more than 10 years, so there's lots of rationalization for that. 2018 is a long time from now. There is a lot of changes going on in Cuba. I think it's hard to think that his successor will be able to carry on the Castro legacy. And why is that? Well, first of all, Fidel has an amazing attachment to the people. He isn't seen as negatively as Raul is. Raul's always been sort of disliked for many reasons. But Fidel always had the charisma. He was always able to talk his way into people's hearts, maybe while he's reaching in their pocket or imprisoning them, but he's always been popular. So if, as and when he goes, and Raul's left, and he tries to pass on something to one of their puppets, I think that could be a real crisis point in the history of Cuba.
Yeah.
I can't see the new guy,
right,
Diaz, getting much support.
Right, the new guy who looks like Jose Canseco. I don't know if you noticed that on the pictures. No, but I also feel that, I mean, you're right about the personality cult that was built around Castro. I mean, that goes back to the very beginning. You know, it was Castro. Castro was the revolution. The revolution was Castro. But I have a feeling that maybe Raul Castro is maybe looking for a way out, that maybe he's not actually going to serve the 5 years, that he may be looking for a way out, because he knows how difficult things are going to be. You know, this subsidy from Venezuela is probably going to be ending here in the next year or two. They're having a very difficult time getting credit from countries. I mean, the Canadians have had to restructure their debts with Cuba, as you know. So maybe, you know, maybe he's looking for a way out. Do you see that possibility?
A very, very strong possibility.
And by way out, let me explain what I mean by way out. I mean, basically, he just picks up one day and says, I'm retiring, and he moves to another country.
Yeah.
There are rumors that, you know, they have a piece of property somewhere in South America, and he just goes over there and says, hey, you guys worry about this. I'm out of here.
Yeah, I think that's very, very strong possibility of that. There is no love for him. Now, he has appointed all the leadership in the army and the interior minister. So he has a lot of friends that have guns. But I don't know how things could really unfold much to his favor.
Yeah, I agree with you, because once Fidel Castro is gone, you're exactly right. I mean, he doesn't have the same relationship with the Cuban people that Fidel Castro had. So now all of a sudden you have this very unpopular guy, and he's going to have to tighten belts, and he's going to have to take things away from people, which is always difficult to do anyway. So I don't know. I'm very skeptical that he will serve the entire 5 years. I wouldn't be surprised if he pulls a Pope Benedict on us and decides that, you know, it's time for me to move on. Now, let me ask you another question about Cuba, and I'm very curious about your perspective since you've been down there. There are some allegations of child prostitution against the Cuban government. What is your reading on that?
I think it goes on, you know, behind closed doors. Now, as I say, I've been going there for 13 years, and I have seen lots of prostitution. You know, I have never seen childhood prostitution. I can't imagine it. It's not in the streets. I've walked around a lot of streets in Havana at all times of day and night, and so it's not something that's out there and obvious. But it happens, certainly happens. Now, there's certainly prostitution. And it's a means of survival there. I mean, I was disgusted when we were down last month. You travel with six guys from Toronto, and you know, they happen to be going to the same place we were, and they were all met by six young women. It's disgusting. I mean, these guys are 70, 75 years old. It might be the easiest money that the women ever made, but it's just disgusting.
Right.
But people are desperate.
Right. Now, what is, in your opinion, or what you've heard, what is the government's involvement in that prostitution business? I mean, is the government, are the Castros basically the pimps of prostitution in Cuba?
I think generally Fidel discouraged it, but appreciated that it would go on. Raul has always had, there's always been talk about Raul. I don't think it's done with the approval of the government. Now, mind you, I can assure you that the police, whether federales or the revolutionary police, get paid bribes. So it certainly happens in front of their eyes. But they get paid to ignore it.
Right. Well, you would think that, you know, you would think that, it, like in many other poor countries, you know, where young women have to survive, you know, you would think that many women, I mean, I've seen all kinds of videos and heard all kinds of stories about how easy the prostitution is in Cuba, and, of course, the health problems always related with prostitution that always come. Now, one last question I wanted to ask you about the political situation in Cuba overall. This last time that you were down there, you mentioned something. You sent me a message today, which was very interesting, that the people of Cuba don't why didn't you say, tell me what you said, because I thought you expressed it very well.
I don't know. I don't remember, Sylvia.
Oh, okay, I think you said something that the foreigners don't know that much about Cuba, and the people of Cuba don't know much about what's going on.
Yeah. No, exactly. Foreigners know more about what's going on in Cuba now than Cubans do, because Cubans don't have access to open media. So, for example, Yanni Sanchez, who I had a chance to meet a few years ago, I mean, she's no bigger than a minute. She might be 5 feet tall and maybe 90 pounds. She's a tiny, tiny woman. But she's gained great fame outside of Cuba, but she's unknown in Cuba.
Interesting.
Yeah, because, of course, they have no open media.
Right, exactly, yeah. Yeah, I mean, that you're exactly right, is that she has no way of blogging within Cuba the same way she does outside of Cuba.
Yeah, and so that, nobody knows she exists. They see this little woman with cameras, and she gets interviewed quite often and everything, but they don't know what's going on.
Now, what about... Go ahead and finish.
No, I was just saying, you know, talking to my friends down there when we were down... few weeks ago, you know, about Fidel and all this sort of thing, they all know that he's close to death. The stories, they do have their gossip, and, you know, they're Cuban, so they like talking. And so they do know that there's something going on, but they don't know all of the dynamics of it. They don't understand the economic issues, for example, because nobody's there to tell them, unless we gringos go down and tell them,
right?
Which they appreciate hearing the stories.
But that's probably the reason why they buy into the embargo is the cause of our problems, because they don't really understand the full picture of the embargo.
Absolutely. And they never hear the other side of the story.
Right. Yeah. And this is, of course, the same thing. I think Ioanni, you know, when I had an opportunity to send her a message, I said, Ioanni, if I felt that lifting the embargo would help the Cuban people, I would call for its lifting tomorrow. But I don't really see how much of a change it's going to have in Cuba. I think it's going to have a great change as far as the government, you know, having more dollars and or more credit lines specifically. And the companies that the Castros are behind, those companies are going to make bigger profits. But as far as the people of Cuba, I don't expect any changes. Now, when you were down there, did you hear anything about Las Damas en Blanco?
You know what, never heard anything in internally. Did see some of the women walking around, but never had any contact with them or any sign of a presence. Now, I will say that a couple of days before I was down there, talking to a guy from Ireland, and he said, you know, he had a great description. He says, yeah, Cuba's better. He says, better for the people who hang around tourists, hang around this part of town, because people give them money. But everybody else are doing worse. And he says, and you think that the Cuban police have calmed down? There was a woman in front of the Capitolio last Wednesday, he said. And she started screaming, complaining about the government. The police showed up and started hitting her with nightsticks.
Wow. That's pretty interesting.
I mean, yeah, it's nothing. The more we say, plus la chance, plus la même chose, the more things change, the more they stay the same.
Yeah.
Now, I will say one thing about what I noticed down there is that there are a lot fewer grays, a lot fewer of the revolutionary police in the streets. You could count on seeing one of the grays on every street corner in the tourist areas. You don't see them there anymore. Now, I don't know what that means. So, you know, what it means, but you don't see as much presence. The other thing that you see now is fresh fruits and vegetables, because people are allowed to grow fruits and vegetables and sell them. So you see carts on the street selling fruits and vegetables that you can sell in a grocery store in the United States. First time I've seen that in Cuba.
Yeah.
Why? Because people are allowed to grow it and sell it.
Right. Interesting. This is Silvio Canto in Dallas, and we're talking to Brian Lloyd French. Brian is a Canadian. He's the author of the book Mojito, which we certainly would recommend. It's a great novel. You're going to love it. It reads quickly, and it's just a novel that will really grab your attention. You won't be able to put it down. But you're also going to learn a great deal about Cuba by reading Brian's novel. And one more question I want to get into with you, one more topic, and that is eventually there's going to be a transition, obviously, to what is in Cuba now to what comes later. What, when you sit down with some of your Cuban friends, what are they hoping for? I mean, are they hoping for a different Cuba? Has anybody explained to you what they're looking for?
I don't think they can have a vision of what could come from change. Appreciate. There are very few people who remember. There are no people who remember a fully democratic Cuba. But there are very few people that have any appreciation of even what democracy is.
Wow, that's interesting. So, that's an interesting point.
So they can't have hope because they don't. They can't have any aspirations towards something. They would like to have more money.
Right.
They would like to eat better. Right. They would like better clothing. They would like to have a moto.
Right.
But they don't have an appreciation of what democracy would be. They still they're little. You can have conversations in places you didn't used to be able to have conversations because you don't have the gray police on every street corner. So you can sit in the patio and have cervezas and smoke cigars and shoot the breeze with Cuban guys when you couldn't do that 5 years ago. So there are some changes.
But when they're yearning for things, you know, beyond the iPods and the computers and stuff like that, you know, the material things, does anybody say to you, I would like to have a Cuba where, you know, there's lots of newspapers and there's freedom of the press? Do they say stuff like that?
They wouldn't have any understanding of even what that would mean.
Interesting. Yeah, because you're exactly right. I mean, it's almost 50 years since anything like that existed. More than that, 54. And so that would mean that people in my parents' generation would remember a pre-Castro Cuba, but the overwhelming majority of Cubans were born after, and they were raised in the system, and, you know, what could they possibly, you know, unless they've had the opportunity to travel, and that would be a very small number of them.
Think of your parents, Silvio, who, and remember we were looking at videos from pre-Castro Havana a few months ago, and what a beautiful, functioning, busy city it was, how well-dressed everybody was. Your parents would remember that. But contemporary Cubans don't.
Right.
They can't even imagine a Cuba or a Havana that's like a modern city.
That's right. Now, you mentioned Havana. How is the infrastructure? You know, for years, the infrastructure was just falling apart. You know, the city, the buildings, it was almost sad to watch it. Has any of that changed?
No, it's still, you know, it's a work in progress. It's getting worse. There's no sign that, you know, they got some Chinese buses a few years ago, so they don't have the old camel buses as much anymore. But there is no infrastructure there. There is none.
Now, have you been able to travel inside the country? I mean, outside of Havana, for example, there used to be something called La Carretera Central, which is the main highway that connected mm-hmm. east and west. Has that been expanded or improved at all over the years, or is it still the same way it used to be? You know, it's basically a two-lane road.
Well, we were driving around this last trip, and the highway is horrible. By the way, I tried to drive through her neighborhood, and frankly, it wasn't the sort of place that I'd want to get out of my car. I mean, it was a lovely neighborhood when her family left it, and it's just deteriorated so badly. But the roads they don't have frost or things like that, so the roads don't deteriorate, but they're not to any North American standard.
Now, go ahead, because I wanted to ask you another question.
Yeah, go ahead.
No, I was going to ask you, what about the very famous, and it was indeed very famous, Tunnel of Havana, which was at the time in the late 50s, you know, was like, you know, one of these great sources of pride in Cuba, that we had this great tunnel that connected Havana. It was, I guess it went under the bay. Is that still functional?
Yeah, it certainly is. It's quite modern. It's probably about the one thing that's survived the time.
Yeah, well, I guess those things were well built.
It's over Casablanca.
Yeah.
It's beautiful over there.
Right. And the old Hemingway restaurant, what was that one again?
The Floridita. Yeah. The Floridita and the Bogadita.
Right.
You go in there, typically a bus will stop out front. The people will get out of the bus, they'll go in and pay $6 for a daiquiri and get back in the bus and go somewhere else. So it's not a place where anybody else goes. But there are some restaurants there. They're really terrific, really terrific. I mean, the people down there are amazingly resourceful.
Right. Yeah, and I've always felt that that's going to be, you know, a big plus after that there is a change. The Cubans are very good at, you know, at making something out of nothing. And when you see these automobiles in the streets, I mean, some of these videos I've seen of these, you know, 1954 cars and 1955 cars, it's amazing how they keep them running. It's got to be, for someone like you, that's got to be very interesting when you see these cars.
No, but you see more of them. I think somebody's bringing them in on truckloads and something, and just because there's such a market for them. I mean, you get an extra, you know, 5 pesos or something for a taxi if it's a 50s Buick.
That's got to be, I mean, you know, just being a, I mean, I love old cars, and that's got to be a tremendous experience. Well, any last thoughts, anything that we haven't covered, anything that you wanted to say about Cuba?
Well, I just want to say one thing. You know, it's funny, Scarface was on TV the other night, and I watched it, and at the end of it, it had this disclaimer about how this was not representative of Cuban people, and most Cuban people
right.
do this and that, and they're all nice and all those sorts of things. Well, Cubans, of course, next to Canadians, are about the most honest people and have the least crime of any group I know. You know, but there's a sensitivity there because of the movie Scarface. Now,
yeah.
Cubans down there are like the Cubans up here. There's some bad ones. There's some, you know, but most people just try to get along.
Right, and I think that it's hard to understand what it would be like to live in a country like that unless you've lived there. I mean, I've spoken to relatives and friends who you know left Cuba. And, you know, we have conversations, and sometimes I'll ask them, you know, why did you do this? And they say, well, because I had to survive. And
mm-hmm.
Things that appear that, for example, you know, we, because of our prosperity, lying and cheating are things that, you know, we don't think we have to do. You know, we don't have to lie or cheat to get food or whatever. But when you live in Cuba, you have to. You have to be that way. So, I mean, that I think that creates an individual that is a lot different than the individual, let's say, raised in Canada or in the United States.
Yeah, no, but they have to. But there is such communalism, you know. I'll just finish with one little story. I don't know, 10 or 12 years ago, I met a guy named Roberto Valdez, who's a band leader down there, and he had this little group of musicians. He called them his muchachos, and they're street kids. And he said, they play tonight, they eat tonight. If they want to eat tomorrow, they eat tomorrow. They play tomorrow. And I said, well, you don't have very much. How do you survive? He says, well, my friend, we have very little. We have our family. We have our friends. We have our music. We have our rum and cigars. You know, we have our novias, and we have our intimacies. He said, to save our souls, some of us have religion.
Interesting.
And I said, you know what? That seems to be what everybody in North America wants.
Yes, that's an interesting.
But with a little food, more food, and nicer cars, and houses.
That's right. That's right. Well, just one. You mentioned music, and I just wanted to say something very quickly here. That of course, Bebo Valdez was the great Cuban musician
yeah.
of
yeah.
a few generations ago. He died mm-hmm. at age 94, and you know, recently you had that album that was recorded in Cuba, the Social Club, Buena Vista Social Club. Where a lot
mm-hmm.
of these artists were found. I think it was a Canadian, wasn't it, who went down there and actually found these artists. But when you go down to Cuba, what kind of music do you hear?
You hear a lot of traditional music in the tourist areas. Juan DeMarco, who started Buena Vista Group, and he still has a band down there. He's still performing down there. Chucho Valdez still lives in Havana. So
Bebo's son, right? Chucho is Bebo's
son.
That's right.
He was in Toronto. I saw him in Toronto a month or two ago. Just an unbelievable musician. But we probably have better Cuban music in Toronto than in Havana now, because so many live up here. But you know, Herrero Duran lives up here. We have just an amazing Cuban music up here in Toronto. But there is jazz. There's very active jazz down there. There's very active hip hop and fusion music. Who's the woman? Suarez, Danny Suarez,
right.
is a woman who could be a star in the USA. So there's a lot of fusion. There's surprisingly the black people are able to do music which would be seen probably not as appropriate a few years ago. So you're seeing a lot more hip hop and the rap and that sort of music down there. So. The music is evolving immensely down there.
Well, interesting, you mentioned black people. There was a very interesting article in the New York Times. In fact, they featured it over at the Babalu blog, you know, of many black Cubans basically feeling shortchanged by the revolution, that somehow they just have not benefited as much by the revolution as maybe they were expecting it. Did you see that when you were down there?
No, there's no question. You very seldom will see a black person in a position where they handle money, for example. And, of course, because so much of the economy is underground, if you don't handle money, then you can't operate much in the underground economy. So almost all the waiters, almost all the doormen, almost all the people who deal with tourists are white. You almost never see a black person in a managerial role. So you don't. Most of the police, some of them are black, most of them are mulatto.
Right.
But it's very clear. It's very clear. And in the countryside, the blacks live a very, very bad life in Cuba. I have friends who have relationships with people down there that tell me, you know, they have a very difficult time.
Yeah.
So there's no question that black Cubans have not been treated equal.
Now, what about when you walk into a government office? Do you see the same racial breakdown? I mean, if you walk into, let's say, the airport or, you know, somewhere to do something of a legal nature, maybe walk into a bank to exchange money, do you see the same advantage to white Cubans?
All the people in the airport are white or mulatto,
right.
Spanish at least. And it's interesting, the statistics that they're coming up with are showing it. A population of Cuba, which is 50% Spanish or 60% Spanish, and of course Spanish isn't a race, but most of the population, probably half the population, are mulatto, and probably, you know, a balance of 50-50 of the rest of the population. But the black people are a minority, and they don't have very much opportunity in Cuba.
Yeah. Now, of course, that is the exact opposite of the propaganda, because even the, you know, when Jesse Jackson went down there and people like that go down there, they come back saying, well, blacks are better treated now than ever. But what you're saying is that's not the case, and that's what other people are telling me.
That's nonsense. Like black Congress in the U.S. go down there, and again, they're on a guided tour.
Right, exactly.
So, the black congressional Congress, they'll go down there and they'll only go to meetings which are appropriately populated by people that will support the propaganda machine.
Right, and even when they have these government meetings, you know, the Congress where you see Raul and some of the people around him, you don't see a lot of black Cubans in positions of leadership. I mean, they're primarily white Cubans.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah.
There are a few generals in the army. There's certainly people. There are people in the Congress that are black, but the government is largely a Spanish white.
Yeah, the white Cubans. Yeah.
Yeah, and the lighter your skin, the more advantage you have as a mulatto.
Now, what about the police? When you were down there and saw police officers, is that true of the police officers also?
I've seen black police officers, most of them are mulatto.
Interesting. Now, I think I bring this up because, as I mentioned, this article that ran in the New York Times indicating that there was great dissatisfaction among black Cubans. They just didn't feel that the revolution has done for them what everybody is telling them that the revolution has done, you know. They hear that the revolution has been great for black Cubans, but they don't see it. They don't have any tangible evidence of it. What about the schools and the universities, college graduates, and that kind of thing? The same breakdown?
You know, the schools, and we know a family down there, girl, it's really interesting. You look on my Facebook page, I've got pictures of her going back the years, and she's 13 now. The kids go to school generally till noon. A lot of their education is political education. In the universities, you have no chance if your family isn't properly positioned in society. So if you've had a father or grandfather or something who served in the mountains or served in Angola or did something like that for the government, then you have a chance to get in university. But it's it's still overwhelmingly white and light mulatto.
Right. But what's interesting about all of this, Brian, and I suspected all of this from talking to people, that here I'm talking to somebody who's been down there, who's lived down there, and you're basically saying that this is a country 50 years after a revolution where, frankly, there's very little progress. I mean, there's very little of this revolution has done for the Cuban people.
Yeah,
very little.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's been a disaster.
And this is...
I mean, think of it this way. Now, Batista, of course, who was mulatto.
That's a good point. Most people don't know that, but you're exactly right.
And, you know, like, under his dictatorship, the people lived very, very well. Pictures from the time, blacks and whites walking down San Rafael, the shopping street, dressed nicely. You know, it was a terrific city. There was no possible way that Cuba would be worse today if Fidel hadn't taken over.
Right.
There's no possible way.
Right.
It would have been better if he hadn't. It couldn't help but be better.
That's right. So I think that, you know, the bottom line is 54 years of a revolution. The results are not there. People are not better off. And, you know, I don't know if you saw this article that Carlos Eide wrote back on the 1st of January, where he wrote an article basically comparing the 54 years of Cuba from independence, let's say, to roughly 59, and then the 54 years after. And the comparison is so much in favor of the pre-Castro government in so many ways, not just macroeconomic, but immigration, for example. Cuba was blessed with lots of immigration during that time.
Mm-hmm.
It's the exact opposite now. People are looking to leave.
Mm-hmm.
And I just think that, you know, what is refreshing about conversing with someone like you, Brian, is that, you know, you're basically saying, look, the place is a disaster. Nothing good has happened under Castro. But yet, it's hard to hear that from so many people in the West who seem to be, I don't know, intoxicated, whatever it is, with the revolution. And maybe they hate the United States so much that they have to believe that stuff. I don't know.
I think we're in a postmodern time where facts don't matter. I mean, I'll even draw a worse comparison. If you look back at video and pictures from the Machado rebellion in the 1920s, Havana looked wealthier and more modern in the 1920s than
That's
it
right.
does now.
No, and in fact, there's a great video in YouTube that I would recommend to the listeners because I've seen it several times because it's so impressive. It's Havana in the 1930s. And the site of Havana, this elegant city, and you just look at the people, and you see black people as well. It's not just white people.
Yeah.
And you see this elegant city in the 1930s, and you're saying to yourself, my goodness. And then there's another one from 1958 or 59 called Havana Holiday, which is, again, it's a promotional film. I mean, let's be honest about it. It's being done to promote tourism. But, you know, you cannot make up video. I mean, you cannot make up the video they were showing because it was from the city of Havana. And you see this elegant city. You see scenes that you could take out of an American city in the 1950s, you know, particularly in the way people dressed and the elegance of the ladies and so on. I mean, it's really sad the way all of that was devastated by the revolution. And I guess the hardest thing for me is knowing that there are people who still buy into it, you know, that somehow still go down there and pay their respects to these two thieves. That's what they are, just a couple of ladrones, frankly, just a couple of thieves.
Yeah, and the worst part is they call us crazy.
Well, no, you're exactly right. They call us right-wing crazies, I guess, you know, batistianos. I guess we're members of the CIA, Brian. You and I, you didn't know that, but you and I are actually members of the CIA, and we've been operating. You know, I keep saying that I said this last night on the show that I think the Cubans in the United States ought to do a class action lawsuit because we never got paid by the CIA. We've been accused of being members of the CIA and being on the CIA payroll, but we never got paid. But we're going to have to wrap it up, my friend, but it's been an absolutely amazing chat. I'm glad we had a chance to get more extended tonight and just have a wonderful chat. But say one more time, tell us one more time about your book and your website And as I said, we have a link on the show information, but go ahead and tell us a little bit more about it now.
Well, I'll tell you, I got a terrific CIA guy in it. His name's Hadrian Felix.
Okay.
Felix being a tribute to Felix Leiter from the James Bond books. But,
that's it.
And I'll tell you, something happens that results in the White House going nuts.
Okay. All right. That's we'll leave that for the listeners to inquire and get your book. But the book is called Mojito, and I love that name, by the way, Mojito, which, of course, well, I think Cubans know what Mojito is. What do your Canadian friends say about that title?
We drink a lot of mojitos up here, you know, because of the cold place and the lime juice and everything and all the sugar and the rum, of course. The rum is a very popular drink, but some people want to make it with, like, peach juice or coconut and stuff. But a mojito is a devilish mixture.
That's right. And what's your favorite?
If it has enough rum.
And what's your favorite Cuban dish?
Oh, man. I like ropa. We were talking about ropa earlier, except you can't get it in Cuba anymore.
Ropa vieja, you mean?
Ropa vieja.
Right,
Because, of course, you can't get beef there anymore. A joke I made in one of your friends' Facebook page today, I said, you know, they call them Cuban unicorns, cows.
That's right.
They call them Cuban unicorns. He says, you've never seen one, but they know they both have horns.
That's right. That's exactly right. Well, Brian Lloyd French.
Very good down there.
Yeah. Brian Lloyd French, our good friend up in Toronto. And keep an eye on those Blue Jays. I think they're going to do very well this year. I have a funny feeling that when we do another show later in the baseball season that the Blue Jays are going to be doing quite well. But thank you so much for joining me tonight. As I said, it was a real pleasure to touch base with you and to hear your perspectives on Cuba. They are so unique and so refreshing that, I had a great time. I hope you did too.
I always do, Silvio. And let's bet baseball hats. I'll send you a Blue Jays hat if you guys have a better record than us.
Well, let's do that. But you know, the great thing about Toronto and Texas, they both have a T on their cap. Well, I'm not sure about the Blue Jays. The Blue Jays went back to the old look, didn't they?
Yeah, they went to the old one, yeah.
Yeah, to the 70s look, which actually I thought was pretty attractive. I thought those uniforms back then were very, very attractive. But, I mean, I think the Blue Jays have always had good uniforms. I've always liked that.
I don't care what they wear. They can wear their swim trunks as long as they win 95 games this year.
Well, I think they will. In fact, I'll predict to you they're going to win 95 games this year. I think they will. But, Brian, thank you so much and good night. And thank you again for all the information and for the book. Absolutely great. Thank you so much.
We'll talk soon.
All right. Thank you so much. We're going to take a break and we'll be right back.
Enter the number you wish to call. The number you have entered is not valid. Please enter the number you wish to call.
This is Silvio Canto in Dallas, Texas, and no, your radio has not gone crazy, but every time we
do... The number
we
you
do,
have entered
oh,
is
there
not
we go.
Valid. Please enter the number you wish to call.
Every time we do a long-distance call, I get that lady, and I don't know if this is a conspiracy or what, but...
The number you have entered is not valid. Please try your call again later.
All right. Thank you so much, lady. Thank you so much for that. But anyway, that always happens when we do an international long-distance call, as we did tonight with our friend Brian up in Toronto. Very interesting fellow, Brian. And the book Mojito, you got to get it. You got to get it. It's an interesting book. It really, you know, it's a different book. I guess I have no way to describe it other than to say it's different than anything you've ever read before. It's a spy novel, like he was saying, but it happens, of course, within Cuba, and that's why it's such an interesting view of Cuba. But Brian has a very unique perspective because he's a man who has gone to Cuba, and he has seen Cuba in a way that I think very few people have seen it, and he appreciates, I believe, very much the problems down there, and I think he's reported them over the years in a way that I think a lot of people in the West do not see them, because I think a lot of people in the West are still in love with the revolutionary image of the Castros. And, well, unfortunately, as Brian was saying, nothing good has come out of that revolution. 54 years of a government, a dictatorship, as I like to call it, and nothing good has come of that relationship. It's been really a very bad deal for the Cuban people. And all of you out there who continue to support the Castro government, you know, you need to reconsider, because you're really hurting the people of Cuba, who are the ones who really been hurt by this revolution more than anybody else. Just a quick heads up about tomorrow's program. We're going to do our baseball show tomorrow. We've got David Busby, Carlos Torres, and we've got another friend here in the Dallas area that I don't know his name at the moment. We're lining it up. But anyway, we're going to be talking about the baseball season, and we're going to be making predictions about the baseball season, the different divisions and so on. So we're going to have a lot of fun. We're also going to talk a little bit about the Dallas Stars. You know, they made a very important trade. One of their star players to the Pittsburgh Penguins, Brian Morrow. So they traded him. And we're going to talk a little bit about the Mavericks, too. The Mavericks are showing some signs of life here at the end of the season. So we'll get into all of that, primarily baseball, tomorrow night. My thanks again to Brian Lloyd French, author and Canadian friend. And this is Silvio Canto in Dallas. Have a great evening, and we'll talk to you later. Mexico and the United States are playing a soccer game tonight, so I think I'm going to catch a little bit of that right now. I guess I'll say go America, go the United States. But it's always tough for the United States to win in Mexico, so it's going to be a very tough game. Good night, everybody.